Today we're happy to welcome Sarah Miller Caldicott to our Thinker in Residence feature. Sarah is the author of three books, including her newest, Midnight Lunch, The Four Phases of Team Collaboration from Thomas Edison's Lab. Sarah is not only an experienced business executive, but she is also Thomas Edison's great-grandniece. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you so much.
We're so happy to have you speaking with us. I think collaboration is maybe an unsung hero, maybe a unrecognized power in business right now, so this is pretty exciting. Let's start our conversation where your three books start, though, with Thomas Edison, and what makes Edison such a rich character to explore, and why do you have this drive to contemporize his practices?
Well, Edison is a rich character to explore, and I think part of this stems from the fact that not only was he an extraordinary inventor, but he had the ability to bring things to market. He was creating commercial successes with his inventions. This is really the key to being a successful innovator. Over the course of Edison's first 40 years as a business person, he created over $6 billion in commercial value. I think that is extraordinary. That figure is actually expressed in 1910 dollars. So if we looked at that 40 years today, it would exceed $100 billion. So part of what makes Edison so amazing is that he was able to generate this type of marketplace success. And much of how he did this was through what today we would call disruptive innovation, the types of innovations that are really difficult and challenging. He created entirely new markets, and amazingly, these markets still exist today. We can think about recorded sound, document duplication, electrical power, motion pictures, portable power in the form of the battery. I mean, these are all things that Edison conceived and created entirely new ways for our civilization to function. So this is a big part of what makes Edison such a rich character, is the magnitude of his inventions and also the skills that he used to create those huge markets.
That's a fascinating point that there really is a productivity to his work that sometimes we don't equate with collaboration, or maybe we mistake brainstorming with collaboration. And in the book, you also draw a distinction between teamwork and collaboration. What is it that you want to emphasize there in terms of difference between those two sorts of focuses?
Sure. Well, teamwork, I think, becomes a big bucket that we toss lots of activities into, and I think we do this kind of casually. In many instances, teamwork involves a collection of tasks where people do their part, and they contribute their effort, and then they're done. And there's nothing wrong with that type of teamwork. However, collaboration, I think, is different. It is more of a continuum. It doesn't have that stop-start nature to it. It is really a leveraging of skills and capabilities of the people who are on the team, and doing that out over time in a way that actually magnifies the strengths of the team. So collaboration is allowing for the presence of more complexity. It allows for the expansion of skills and capabilities in a way that I think that standard teamwork doesn't necessarily do. So Edison really focused on collaboration as the primary engine, if you will, of his laboratories.
One of the things that really stood out to me while reading Midnight Lunch, and I can hear it as you're discussing the book with us and its subject, is your passion for collaboration. And you open the book by correlating collaboration and gravity. It's an elegant beginning that's really quite tangible for people. Really, people can really get a hook into why and how you feel collaboration is so important. And so could you tell us a little bit about why these two forces are similar, at least in the way that you equated them in the beginning of your book? And maybe that there's some disregard to just how impressive these two forces are?
I think that's right. I think gravity and collaboration are similar because they are both pervasive and they both often operate in the background and yet have tremendous power. Gravity really has the power to shape our planet, to identify how we walk on the surface of the Earth, how we function in our everyday lives, and it operates without our knowing and often without our appreciation. Collaboration is a lot like that, where there are actually connections between people, connections between teammates that don't get recognized and aren't therefore brought forward for focus or development. So collaboration is crucial to this sort of unseen glue, this invisible glue, if you will, that holds teams together. And really, that's what gravity does. It holds things together, and it's a binding force that isn't necessarily heavy-handed. We don't feel it pressing on us. It is simply present. So because collaboration is so subtle, I think it's something that bears our focus and bears looking at in a way that we can kind of deconstruct it, if you will, and look at the facets of collaboration as they operate. It allows us to be more aware of it and to actually use it and leverage it more.
Which is really what your book is about. And I think that is something that the true value is in this methodology that you bring to collaboration, which people might think is a soft subject to some degree. Can you help us define true collaboration as you use it and what your methodology for organizations to achieve high-performing collaboration is?
Well, true collaboration is the term that I give to how Edison viewed the collaboration process. And actually, he felt that collaboration operated more as what we might call the backbone of his innovation process. So collaboration and innovation were connected for Edison. And if we look at it that way, I think we find one of the missing links in what powers innovation or where we have kind of forgotten to look as we observe the innovation process at work in the 21st century. True collaboration, as Edison used it, really had four facets. The first I describe as capacity, which is the ability to allow collaboration to exist, allow it to thrive, to create a foundation for it. And in this first phase, capacity, really it begins with the formation of small teams. And small teams that have diverse skill sets present, people who can really work and serve as colleagues together. So when those components are present, the other three phases of collaboration become much easier and more fruitful. The second part of collaboration, as Edison used it, was what I call context. And this is a huge part of collaboration, and again, a piece that we miss. What Edison felt was true about collaboration is that it allowed solutions to emerge. It allowed new context and even new language to emerge. Context is really about allowing people to operate in dialogue and ask questions. The beginning of the collaboration process is really questioning and experimenting. You mentioned brainstorming before. Mm-hmm. A lot of times we begin with brainstorming. And in fact, Edison would start sooner than that, which is, what are the questions we should be looking at? What are some of the ways we can examine those questions? So prototyping, experimenting were part of how he created context. This is where the disruptive innovation part comes in. This is how you generate disruptive innovations, is through this creation of context. The third phase of collaboration is what I call coherence. And that is, how does this team of people stay together? How do you keep them moving forward? A very important part of coherence is inspiration. Does the team feel that they're part of something important, something that's going to contribute to a sense of meaning or purpose. Edison was masterful at painting a big picture for his collaboration teams to connect to. So sometimes that's missing for us today, this inspirational piece. And another bit I would mention with relation to coherence is progress. How are you going to define progress for your team? Today, we look at changes and differences in the way Generation Y, for example, looks at progress. They're searching for that meaning. They're wanting to contribute to something. They're not so much out for financial gain and title. Much of the baby boom generation, however, has been acculturated that way. So they're looking for, you know, how is this going to impact my career and things of that nature. So the definition of progress that a team has is very important to keeping the team together. And the final piece that I would mention is the fourth phase, which is complexity. And this is certainly a huge part of what we deal with today as innovators and in many facets of our business lives. Complexity really was something that Edison embraced within the collaboration process. Much of how we try to approach things today is through efficiency and more linear processes. Edison was really understanding that things were not necessarily sequential, that certain things would need to take place almost simultaneously through exploration and the questioning I talked about earlier. So it wasn't so much about how do we set up something in a linear way, it's how can we create interrelationships, how can we see the patterns, how can we navigate some of these differences and diverse ways of thinking into a larger context. So I think this is part of where Edison was so successful. You mentioned his productivity earlier. Being able to address complexity in a successful way was part of how collaboration operated for Edison.
That's a wonderfully succinct description of your the sort of this framework of your book. And I think it reminds everybody that that this effort to become more collaborative is really one that needs some structure behind it. And I'm curious to know how you feel a leader's role is in defining some, if we go back to maintaining coherence, you said that one way of doing that is to define progress, another is inspiration, and one word I took out of it was momentum, keeping momentum. How does a leader try to become that person who directs collaboration without manhandling it?
You know, and I think this is a fine line. It is part of where we do lose momentum is in the leadership piece.
Mm.
Many times we think of leadership as having to be in control, of having to always give the direction. Part of how collaboration worked for Edison was to create frameworks and guidelines and then allow the team to actually have latitude in how they fulfilled that framework. So whether it was through inspiring his teams to reach higher, and to look for something different or something that might not seem obvious, or whether it's through what I call in the book shoulder-to-shoulder leadership, which is actually working with the team, sitting with the team, talking with the team, reading their notebooks and their entries. This was how Edison was able to become part of the fabric of what was happening within the team itself. So part of the balance of leadership today becomes this overarching ability to create a guiding framework that doesn't try to totally control and squeeze out some of that creativity, and the ability to be a colleague, the ability to operate with a team. If you were to come into the room as a leader, what would happen? Would people be afraid? Would they openly welcome you into their circle, and could you kind of connect into their dialogue? That's really where shoulder-to-shoulder leadership comes in. can you work and roll up your sleeves with a team? Do you have the capability? So leaders today need to be able to do both of those things. And Edison, you have that capability. And we see this in the marketplace now. We can read about it in the business press. But it isn't as common as I think it needs to be. It isn't as valued as I think it needs to be, these two qualities of leadership. So that's an area that we could certainly emphasize.
It really does seem to be that it's, you know, collaboration is about the people. And I love this idea of shoulder to shoulder and really, you know, everyone working toward the same purpose, but, you know, still having some sort of guiding voice going on there. But obviously when you get a number of people involved in a project, and I think this is what makes people refrain from really productive collaboration, that things get complicated. And in, I'd like to just read a little quote here from your book. Collaboration holds the power to link teams with diverse skills and traits, urging them to come together in an aligned way and yielding breakthroughs that can impact hundreds, even millions of people. So here you reference that once you create a chain of people, or, you know, a foundation of people, that everything else gets stronger because of that.
Yes.
But the funny thing is that it's very difficult to get people to collaborate, it seems. I think there's a lot of fear in giving up control and being responsible to other people and not yourself. So I'm curious as to how the solo and group meld, which are two terms that you use in the book, can help avoid some of these barriers to collaboration.
Yes, you know, and you bring up the solo meld and the group meld, which is part of the second phase, the context phase. And the solo meld is fascinating because it, in Edison's view, is the time when we look at our own mental framework. We ask ourselves how objective we can be about a given subject, how we look at risk, how we are able to change our ways of thinking. The solo meld is a process of almost igniting your own creativity, your own wiring, and looking at it in a way that can connect into a team's effort in the most powerful way possible. So part of the solo meld process is looking at what I call your mental model. How is it that you're operating? Do you feel that you always need to be the one in control?
Mm-hmm.
So asking those questions of yourself is one of the beginning points. And it allows you to then shift your framework over the course of the collaboration and begin to see yourself in a new way. This was a hugely important part of how Edison asked his employees to operate. Within the group meld, part of the value here is that collaboration itself succeeds through the generating of common experiences. So collaborations function because they hold a common content. They're aiming for something that unites them. So being able to articulate what that is, what that thing is that unites them, is an important part of the collaboration itself in the group meld process. So it becomes a part of their purpose, of their goals. And this is different from an agenda. I think when people have an agenda, it gets into the control piece that you spoke of. It gets into the, okay, we're going to try to force fit this into something that's going to rise to the attention of a certain person and going to get them a promotion.
Mm-hmm.
So the group meld part is important because it emphasizes skills like dialogue and allows people to begin to talk and air some of their what would be called private information or information that's expert to them or uniquely resident within them. As people feel that they can share some of that, that adds power to the collaboration process. If people are reserving and withholding some of their best stuff, then the collaboration is not as successful. So part of what we can see a collaboration doing is creating a greater level of comfort for people to share in a casual form of dialogue and really connect into what expert knowledge other people have. As they feel that momentum building, it generates more trust and allows the momentum to continue for a project.
So I'm curious then if you would formally say that, and our readers may have already guessed this, but that the title of your book, Midnight Lunch, and hopefully you can tell us a little bit more about that, but that that might be an example of Edison actually practicing group meld in terms of this sort of informal sharing of what we all keep in our heads.
Absolutely true. And Midnight Lunch itself was a practice of coming together after work hours. Sometimes people had experiments that they were working on that needed to be monitored or watched over a period of time. So people would stay at the lab. They'd work in their various areas within the laboratory. And often Edison would come after work hours to do some of his own work, his own experiments. And at that time, he would see who was in the lab. He would talk with them. He would check in on their experiments and encourage the people who were there to talk with each other and offer insights or comments on the various experiments that were underway, even if it didn't happen to be in an area of expertise that you held. Oftentimes, we can see a pattern or we can see a process at work with our own mental model, right, in your own solo meld frame, and you can see what someone else is doing and comment on it in a way that offers insight that advances the ball. So this is part of what Midnight Lunch was. At about 7 o'clock, people would return to the lab. They'd work for 2 hours. Edison would talk with them. At 9 o'clock, he'd order in food. And for an hour or so, everyone would sit back, tell stories, sing songs. They'd play music on various musical instruments and just hang out together. Beyond that, they would then continue working. So it was a multi-hour stretch of time when people were really collaborating. They were rolling up their sleeves, looking at what each other was doing, and feeling free to comment and have input with Edison right there. And they would mix the ideas around. So, yes, Edison did contribute to group meld in that process. He was encouraging casual dialogue. He was encouraging people to debate and ask questions and wonder why was an experiment being conducted in a particular way. What this really did was to bake in a skill set that was absolutely priceless for Edison and his laboratories. This is part of what I think we can do today. This is part of what we need to be considering, is this way of approaching questions that is casual and allows people to feel connected. It's got a social framework to it and a work framework to it that's quite unique and dynamic. So this is one of the facets of collaboration I think that Edison was masterful in achieving.
And I think the importance here is that kind of uniting is about more than just morale. It's about opportunity, and it's about, as you said, bringing people together in a way that they're all invested in the sort of end result to keep that momentum and inspiration and everything going. So, again, this isn't just to keep people satisfied, give them food, but it's really about creating sort of a family, I think. And
Well, I was just saying a sense of flatness, quote unquote, and we hear that term, you know, flat teams, flat organizations, and this is really a big part of what is yielded by this process, is a sense of coherence and flatness. Edison wasn't big on titles. He wasn't big on, you know, what we would term a corner office in our world today. He was much more interested in how people came together to solve problems in a framework that reflected deep thinking. So to the extent that he encouraged that, he got a lot of results. This is part of some of the soft side, if you will, of collaboration as well. I would call it a super skill. Mm. It's really the ability to combine data, which involves hard skills, with softer skills like inspiration, dialogue, and connection between between people. Mm-hmm. So it is a combination of hard and soft skills, and Edison was able to bring those things together in a unique way.
Well, it sounds like Edison was a bit before his time in the sense that I got a sense of an urgency to your message in the book, in that you're calling to organizations and leaders to really commit now to creating a collaborative environment. And a lot of that has to do with the talent pool that is out there from which organizations can choose from. And this sort of generational pool seems like they would have loved to work with Edison. So how do today's leaders and organizations sort of connect to that social media, no corner office, no title kind of workforce that's now coming out there?
Well, part of the urgency has to do with demographics and technology coming together. We see on the global stage that between 2010 and 2020, 1 billion working-age adults will enter the global workforce. That is unprecedented in human history. That's a very, very large number. As well, at the same time, we have the proliferation of mobile devices and smart devices happening all over the world. So what will truly be part of the landscape is technology being used by this new workforce in ways that is unprecedented. Because so many of these platforms are mobile, people will be able to participate in work activity in ways that we haven't even thought about yet. So we can see, though, even in our current time, as you mentioned, social media and social networking is a huge part of how we can tap into some of the knowledge assets of this huge body of people. It's how we can tap knowledge assets of our own current workforce. So this feeling of being connected, this feeling of being able to search and find resources that can help address questions is very much at the fore of what leadership needs to be aware of today. So this is part of that urgency. As an organization is looking for new employees and new hires, it needs to be thinking about the fact that Generation Y, this is true not only in the U.S., but across the world, this term Generation Y is being used. Over 50% of the workforce by 2025 will be comprised of this new generation. So organizations need to lay the groundwork for collaboration to be present because younger workers expect it, and they're looking for it. They're deliberately seeking it. So being able to navigate the complexity, which I mentioned as the fourth phase of collaboration, looking at this as part of the complexity of building a workforce is very crucial. Knowledge assets are going to tip the balance for organizations in the coming decade. Your ability to look at your workforce and combine it and recombine it to generate innovation, as Edison did, is going to be the way companies succeed. It's not so much now about sensing and responding or waiting for things to happen and reacting to those. It's more about paving the path, anticipating and creating what's next. So knowledge assets are huge in that. Connectivity is huge in that. So knowing that your workforce has this ability to tap resources rapidly and synthesize information is a big part of how collaboration operates. So that is why I think it is an urgent message for leaders and businesses today.
I think that encapsulates the manifesto-like quality of the book, in that it really is a call to change. And I think we'll leave that as our last note for today. Is there anything else you would like to either mention about, you know, through your investigation of Edison over three books, is there anything that you really want to leave our listeners with, or one more point about the book? Anything else?
Well, one thought I would have is just to encourage people to consider the idea of a midnight mm-hmm. lunch, and to even consider holding their own midnight lunch with six or seven of their friends or colleagues. And this is something I'm going to be looking at out over time, is how to allow and encourage people to be undertaking this very first step of questioning and experimenting, just as Edison did, because it has such a huge ripple effect.
And we can find out more about your ideas on that, let's see, on your Facebook page and on online somewhere. Where can we touch base with you, Sarah?
Yes, absolutely. My Facebook page is Power Patterns of Innovation, and I would welcome your listeners and readers to visit there as well. You can find me on my website, which is www.powerpatterns.com. There's a lot of information about my books and free resources there, all kinds of information about Midnight Lunch and Edison.
Great, and we have an Edison birthday coming up as well, correct?
Yes, that's right. Edison's birthday is February 11th, and it is a wonderful way for us to remember how central Edison is to our lives today, all of these industries that he invented that we can still see in our everyday lives.
Well, you've definitely helped us do that, and we're so grateful to you, Sarah, for taking the time to spend with us and for really bringing Edison's ideas that are rather contemporary on collaboration sort of into our time. Thank you again for joining us, and I hope everyone picks up a copy of Midnight Lunch, because it really is a treat.
Thank you, Sally. It's been a pleasure.